these huge giants, you know, walking amidst the clouds or what have you.
Metal music. It's hard to write a song in an entire minor key and talk about, you know, nice things. Heavier, obviously, doomier at times.
When he came over, and God, when he started singing, bloody hell. I couldn't believe what's coming out of his little body.
Somebody said, anyone got an idea what we should do as a stage set? Jesus and Stonehenge. So there's this dwarf comes out, and he's walking across the top of this Stonehenge.
Pure spell.
Black Shadow!
Rise up to the Sabbath. You're very welcome here today to Sabbath Bloody Podcast. It's Sabography for the masses. We're covering a legit, badass, and completely underrated Sabbath record. Oh, I fucking enjoyed this one. All hail the Eternal Idol. This 80s run is fucking insane. Like, we're only 6 years in, and these offerings are ripe with things to discuss. Tons of variety in the tracks, too. And today is no exception. So let's just pick up right where we left off, then. Get right back into it. When we last left our heroes, the lineup was now the old guards. Tony Iommi, Jeff Nichols, with the hot young rhythm section of Dave the Beast Spitz and Eric Singer. I'll tell you what though, Eric Singer is by far my least favorite drummer of the Sabbath so far. He just makes me miss Bill so much, and Apice even. When I listen to Singer's drum tracks, it's like, come on man, fucking do something, create some space there. You don't have to just play the fucking click track. I mean, he does do some cool little snare bits here and there, but honestly, aside from that, I don't even fucking notice the drums, really. And not in a good blending in kind of way. It's just that they're so generic to my ears. And like I said, it's like the click track behind Tony's riffs, really. But I guess he's serviceable enough. And the stuff he does in Badlands later, after Sabbath, has so much more feel. It's just kind of strange that he just sinks into the studio vibe here. Well, it could be more of a production thing, really. Speaking of Badlands, in the prize vocal slot for Back Sabbath now, of course, you got another young one, Sir Ray Gillen. I know he's kind of blacklisted because of his actions surrounding his death, and he's never officially on a Black Sabbath release, but, well, we'll get to all that today. Ray was an undeniable talent, though, and a huge part of keeping Sabbath alive when old Husey shit the bed over there. So, this new lineup was still on the road, plugging the 7-star record, keeping the ship from sinking after an embarrassing start to the tour. However, the tour support from their manager, Don Arden, got yanked from underneath them quite quickly, causing an uneasy transition into the studio once they wrapped things up. At the time, Don Arden was on trial for his role in alleged assault on his record label partner, a trial which saw his own son actually take the fall for him. So here's a quote detailing that whole ordeal. I'll just read it through here. On March 19th, 1986, David Arden was charged with carrying out his father's instructions to blackmail and imprison Harshal Patel, an accountant who rose to power in the Jet organization, becoming Don's partner. Patel had fallen out with Arden, who had accused him of extorting the company's funds in an excess of $100,000. It was not a vast sum by Arden's financial standards, but rather than pursuing his allegations through the courts, Don allegedly decided to take the law into his own hands, using strong-arm methods. One evening, Don and David Arden, accompanied by two thugs, allegedly held Patel captive for over 24 hours. During this long ordeal, the unfortunate accountant was verbally abused by Arden Sr., who at one point allegedly flew into a rage and threw a cup of coffee over the victim. In an earlier hearing, it was suggested that Patel was beaten up and forced to sign a letter of credit for £69,000. Evidently, Arden had not bargained upon Patel's indignation and willingness to contact the police about the incident. In the past, Don's intimidation tactics had attracted inquiries from the police, but these allegations were arguably the most serious yet, and if proven, would almost certainly place the Ardens behind bars. Dun, 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 dun. There you go. There's the People's Court synopsis for you there. Yeah, some straight fucking mob shit, as always with the Ardens. Ultimately, the Don was acquitted of these charges, but after a long drawn-out legal procedure, the bills proved to be a fatal strain on his label, Jet Records, which collapsed. And that eventually forced him to liquidate all his assets, which included, of course, managing Black Sabbath featuring Tony Iommi. But luckily, Black Sabbath was never on the Jet label proper, so work on their next album could still continue with distribution and such. They're still on that prized UK Vertigo USWB deal, at least for one more album here. And also, Ozzy's solo stuff, which was originally on Jet Records for the Randy Rhoads era stuff, he was also safely over to CBS in their Epic imprint by that point. So don't worry about our old friend Ozzy. Despite Don's troubles, Black Sabbath as a band were re-energized creatively. It seemed that Iommi had finally found a capable and marketable young frontman, Ray Gillen. So they went into the writing process quite quickly. They assembled at their home base, the home of metal, good old Birmingham, England. Seven-star producer Jeff Glicksman was also brought back in to oversee the process. The first studio that they started to assemble songs in was said to be this barn-like loft in a small hamlet just outside of Birmingham. There were apparently shops open for business down below during the afternoons, and Eric Singer even said that he had to rehearse his parts with t-shirts draped over his drums and so as not to get any noise complaints. This is funny. It's like they're becoming a fucking garage band again, right? Personally, I think that the energy of these initial sessions, I think that carries through this album in a good kind of way. It kind of humbles them a little bit, you know? There's more of an alive sound to this record compared to the Seventh Star. It's really the same thing I always rant about between Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules. Like, The Eternal Idol is just so much more fucking awesome sonically than Seventh Star is. It's so much more immediate, and they sound like a band again, especially on the early demo versions that they cut with Ray Gillen singing. And I think the process of them slumming it back in Birmingham before getting into the posh studios, there's some real magic being caught there. Some bonding, as cheesy as that might sound. It's essential for a great album, and it shows on The Eternal Idol. However, the Arden situation got so bad that Tony needed to think fast, find some new management to complete these sessions. That leads us to the first real buzzkill for this Sabbath lineup moving forward, and ultimately, its undoing. In Tony's book, he of course touches on this little transition here, so let's read and see what kind of makeshift situation he comes up with for managing Black Sabbath. So Tony writes about finding a new manager. "At that point, it was really difficult to find someone who could manage us. Then Wolf Pine approached me. He said, 'Patrick Meehan can help you out.' Same old thing. It's ridiculous, I know. It was a stupid thing to do, but we got back with Meehan. The people who surrounded me were trying to rip me off anyway, so my thought was, it might as well be someone I know and who might do something for me while he's about it. The devil, you know. It's all a bit vague now because it was a period when I was back into doing a lot of coke again, and so was Meehan. So I got involved with Meehan again, and of course, bang, it went pear-shaped immediately. He got into too much of that Playboy thing again. I went to a couple of places with him, and he introduced me to some dodgy people. Nice people, but dodgy people. And I thought, here we go again." That's right, Supernauts. Patrick fucking Meehan. Again, the scumbag who crippled Sabbath's back catalog heading into Sabotage. Why, Tony? I mean, say what you will about the Don, at least he was helping the band get out there and move on, find new fucking members. Sure, his ideas were questionable, like Stonehenge and fucking the Painted Dwarf concepts on Born Again, but hooking Tony up with Ian Gillan, that was a fucking great move. Oh, well. At this point, though, the snake is eating its own tail, right? So Iommi is just as much to blame for any of the fuckery moving forward brought on by Meehan. I'm done defending you, Iommi. Did I ever really defend him? I don't think so. I've always been kind of hard on Iommi on the show, haven't I? Anyway, Patrick Meehan did start flexing his cash flow right off the bat, which helped move things forward on the new album front. He also arranged for the boys to get out of dirty old England and go to the sunny West Indies, record at the famed Air Studios, which was a Caribbean island haunt owned by producer George Martin of Beatles fame. He was granting kind of tax loopholes for recording artists who were connected enough to grace his studio there. And Sabbath ended up being there for 6 weeks, commencing around late September and well into October. Here's who goes in. You got Tony Iommi, Jeff Nichols, Ray Gillen, Eric Singer, David Spitz, Patrick Meehan, who's assuming a executive producer role as well as managing, aka managing the Snowdrifts coming into the studio, I imagine. Then you got producer Jeff Glicksman, an engineer called Chris Sangerides. He's in the booth there. It seems like it was a very isolated studio, too. It more or less becomes a series of Survivor here. And the first one voted off the island, of course, is the Beast, David Spitz. No one wants to declare what Spitz did to get the boot off the island, but it's hinted that something went down between him and Glicksman. And Tony says he had other things to deal with on the mainland or something like that. Who knows? He was not fired from Sabbath. He was just relieved of his studio obligations at the time. And just a theory here, but I think them wanting to bring in a co-writer with a proven track record was part of the reason that Spitz was sent packing. Because the next to join the island party was Ozzy Osbourne's fixer himself, and an extremely capable bassist. So I think that's where Spitz might have rubbed wrong about this. But Mr. Bob Daisley. Daisley was still in the Ozzy camp at the time too, albeit on and off, having just finished Bark at the Moon co-writes with him. His main gig now, though, was with Gary Moore, so the Sabbath thing was kind of a studio-only deal for Daisley. Even with Iommi wanting to bring him on to the bass slot full-time, Daisley knew that he'd just come in there, write songs, get out. And Daisley really helped. He brought some solid songwriting to the table, and most importantly, the lyrics. And you can fucking tell there's a new writer, too. A lot of the tracks scream Bob Daisley, early Ozzy kind of flavor. And the riffs, too. It's a big part of the appeal of this record, for me at least. Like Ancient Warriors, it has this total like No More Tears feel at points, like riff-wise. Daisley's flavor is just all over this LP, and I fucking love it. He writes some great stuff for Ray Gillen to sing too, who apparently wasn't bringing shit to the table in the lyrics front. So they made a lot of headway on the tracks with Daisley there. And they never got to finish the album in Montserrat with Gillen's vocal tracks still kind of stalling out the process. Things broke down with Glicksman, too, after arguments of Ray Gillen's involvement or lack of. I don't know if Gillen was the big problem, as it was stated in multiple interviews. That was kind of said after the fact. I mean, his tracks on the demos sound fucking great to me, but he may have been tough to work with. So either way, Glicksman's done with him, and the crew all returned back to England. Bob went back to Gary Moore, and Glicksman went back to America. And the omnipresent Patrick Meehan was quick to bring in a new producer, Vic Coppersmith Heaven. Yes, his last name is Heaven, folks. But you might remember him as Vic Smith, a former Sabs engineer, actually, back on Volume 4, baby. So the man working the wheels of confusion there, with Tony co-producing with Meehan, if you recall the Volume 4 studio debacle. Are you seeing the connection here, though? I think that Vic was part of Meehan sinking his vulture talons deeper into the things here, bringing the old guard in, whom he knows won't question his motives and shit. You know, letting fucking Patrick Meehan take his producer cut. Well, Vic does all the real work. You know the deal. Ray Gillen decided that he was fucking done. He left. He had already pretty much completed his tracks, but he no longer wanted to be part of Black Sabbath with Meehan cooking the books. I would have liked to see them carry this material through with Gillen, actually, so it's too bad there. Eric Singer also followed suit a couple of months later after locking off his drum tracks, that's fine by me. He wasn't bringing anything to the Sabbath, but. So it was back to just Tony and Jeff again. It's around March of 1987 by this point, so Tony needed to think about the future here, with summer and the prime tour season kind of fast approaching. Does he mix the album with the Gillen tracks and just release it as is and figure out how to tour it? Or does he strip out the Gillen tracks, find a new fucking singer, have a new voice moving forward, kind of start again? Tony said, let's do the latter. Fuck it. We're pressing on. We don't need to be shelling out any money to somebody who doesn't want to be in the Sabbath. So, who can we get to retrack it fast? So here's a quote from Iommi's book on the acquisition of the next Sabbath singer, and the last new Sabbath singer. This is big for the show here. We're in the final stretch, folks. All the players are in play. Well, I guess there's a couple of drummers and bass players to come in, but for the most part, things kind of settle down here in the roster. Tony writes, by the time we got into Battery Studios, Ray Gillen had left. My friend Albert Chapman managed this guy called Tony Martin. He said, try him, he's got a good voice. Tony came into the studio without having had any warning or anything to sing some of the tracks we had written with Ray in mind. He sang some of the stuff similar to Ray, following some of the melody lines that we had already recorded. he did really well. So we replaced Ray's vocals with Tony's voice. So here he is, Tony the Cat Martin. An interview clip here, talking about how he fit into the band.
The first call I got for Black Sabbath was when Glenn Hughes was in the band at the Seventh Star album. And I was put on hold because I was having problems with Glenn. And then they managed to fix that. And then the next call I got from Sabbath was when Ray Gillen disappeared. And they needed a singer. I was a complete rookie. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, they took me out of a band called The Alliance, and we had a deal with Warner Brothers at the time, but we weren't doing much. And so when they sort of put me in front of Sabbath, I was absolutely, completely inexperienced. I mean, they took me out of a local Birmingham band and stuck me in front of one of the most famous names on the planet. Also, they're 10 years older than me, so our friends' circles weren't the same. Our circle of friends didn't sort of mix, so it was a little bit distant and a little bit cold sometimes, but we were friendly, but I can't say that we were best buddies. But we worked pretty good, I thought, and I managed to get the band into a sort of position from being actually quite low. It was difficult for people to work with them at the time. There was kind of having jokes made about them because they had so many singers and different people in the lineup and all the rest of the stuff. And then they took me on, a complete rookie from a small band in Birmingham, so it just about got as low for them as it could get. But we built it up, and I thought we were doing pretty good. So it was scary and it was exciting all at the same time, really. It was a very weird set of emotions to be in the band.
Yeah, the cat's fucking awesome. He seems like a really cool guy, too. There's no ego about him. I'll talk more about the differences between Gillen and Martin's takes, because they're both fucking great. I like alternating the listens, so let's talk about the tracks here. Them fucking riffs that Tony Iommi brought to the table, because...
Power of the riff compels me!
Won't you listen?
Okay, so the opener on the album is fucking strong. The Shining. Huge, shimmery kind of arpeggio guitar part to open. Electric, but just kind of soaked in chorus, so it has kind of an acoustic kind of vibe to it. Ben doesn't quite hit it here, but you'll listen to the album after this, right? Iommi's tone to open is fucking great. Gotta find a pressing of this, actually. I love the mix that's on the digital copy I have, and I imagine it's even better on fucking vinyl, but... kind of calling back to Children of the Sea tone-wise. Right away you can tell that they've took some time in the production here, and in the sequencing too, because The Shining is the perfect album opening single. Even singer's drums, which I slag in comparison to Vinny and Nibby, but they sound more alive than on the Seventh Star. Tony Martin's vocal take is fucking money on this one. Like, this is maybe his strongest on the album, so it's great that it's in that lead-off spot. It gives him a great introduction to everybody. As the voice of Sabbath here moving forward. Very Dio-esque throughout the track, yeah, I get that. He nails those dramatic climbs. That's not a fucking knock on him, though. You know, a little campy, but convincing. It's a fine line that few can walk, and I think Tony's able to do it. There's sort of like a medieval Celtic kind of swing to the verses vocal delivery. There's a man who sees all there is to see what the future holds for all. Yeah, it's pretty fucking camp, especially when I sing it, but... it's awesome in his execution. I picture him dressed in this medieval garb with one of fucking Dio's dragons smoking behind him or some shit. So that flavor's back in a good way. Glenn and Ian were having none of that bullshit. The Shining is also the oldest track on the album, as it was originally written in demo sessions way back in 1984 following the Born Again tour. Actually, I was shown a recording that Dave Donato did. Remember Dave Donato? Talked about him extensively in the Born Again episode. A version of The Shining that was called No Way Out in those lost years of Sabbath. If you want, you can find that on YouTube. Hell, you know what? I'll actually just throw it on at the end of the episode for a laugh. It's pretty fucking bad. So, The Shining had three singers take a crack at it before arriving on the Eternal Idol album here. And like I said, it's a great choice for a single, really. It's kind of poppy, but still fucking rocks. Because check out this evil little riff that Iommi sneaks in the back door here. glorious. Almost Power of the Riff there, but there's a good one at the end of this album. The video for this song was somewhat rushed, though. It comes off as an ad hack kind of thing, as do most Black Sabbath music videos. Let's be honest, they don't catch on in that arena at all. And that might be a big part of why they kind of fade in this era. Let's be honest, their sexy days are long behind them, unless you're into coked up, leather clad John Oates lookalikes. When it came time to shoot the video for The Shining, the band had no actual bassist in place either, so the band ended up pulling in a complete unknown off the street to stand in for the video shoot. You'll also notice a different drummer behind them there. Not Eric. It's actually Terry Chimes, who drummed for The Clash. He filled in for the video and ultimately for a few live gigs eventually, but we'll get into that when we get on the caravan soon enough here. So they did the video very early on. Tony Martin's still there, the cat with his big fucking widow's peak in full effect. I mean, I get it. Image-wise, I can see why people slag on Martin. He doesn't have the stage presence of Ozzy or Ian Gillan, or Ray Gillan for that matter. He beats out bloated Glenn Hughes, but just barely. Okay, we'll burn through some of the other tracks here. An incredible album, riffs galore, but unfortunately, Ben doesn't cover much of it on his YouTube channel, so I'm just going to have to run through some quick thoughts here. We won't dwell on it as much as I usually do. I've actually been told that I got to figure out a way to move through the track list quicker here by one of my listeners. But I feel like this section is where I can actually get opinionated and shit, so that's why I kind of get snagged up every once in a while. I'll try to keep it moving here, though. So track two, a song that's demo version was called George the Axe Murderer, which was a title after a chef that they had in the West Indies when they were recording this. By the time it made it through the Bob Daisley song filter, though, it became a badass, medieval, kind of tinged war song called Ancient Warrior. An incredible track, too. Lyrically, it could be viewed as a little cheesy. It's very kind of like 90s Megadeth to me. But that's not really a knock on it, because I fucking love that shit. Like, let me bring them up here, since I don't have the riffs to play. Let's look at the words. This stuff sounds like it could be on, like, Euthanasia or one of those 90s Megadeth albums. Risk, even. There's no end, there's no beginning to the old man's story. Does he still remember me? From lives gone by, oh, I see his spirit rising upon the back of time. Upon the back of time. I love how he hits that. I've got nowhere to hide. Will he keep a place for me? He is the king of all kings, the keeper of light. He holds eternity's wings. Yeah, it's a very fucking cool track. Nickel's key stylings are great on it too. It sounds like E5-150 again. Some leftovers from Mob Rules, which is a good thing for me because I fucking love that album and I love the synth tone that he generates on there. 5 stars for the Ancient Warriors. So fucking good. So then from that track, it's on to a nice little raunchy one to bring the party up. Hard Life to Love, which isn't really a standout, but it's still pretty damn cool. I mean, the album isn't all straight fire, let's be honest. As much as I love it, it does have some filler pretty quickly in the track list. I'm like, we're not looking at the second coming of fucking Mob Rules or Master of Reality here. It's more like Born Again level badass, which in my books is still very fucking high. Like, I'm telling you, like, I think The Eternal Idol is one of my top 7. I mean, it's definitely one of my top 10 Black Sabbath records already. So, and I haven't really spent that much time with it. So, who knows where it could climb to. Hard Life to Love in that 3 spot. It kind of eases you into the more generic metal-leaning stuff that pops up in the album here. Still hanging on from the 7-star, but, you know, not as much as there was on there. Like this next one, which is a low point for my taste, but still a pretty good song. Glory Ride. You check out the lyrics on this one. Bob Daisley would have penned these again. Winged with steel, they fill the air. The soldiers of fortune will ride in the sights of the enemy's gun. Those who have taken their oaths tonight are well prepared. They know they'll do or die, even if it's suicide. Let's take a chance. As the skies will burn tonight, wasted lives and spirits run free on the wings of no return. And the galloping guitars dun, 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 are in fucking full effect on this one, which I never cared for. Like, the thrash guys do way cooler stuff with their picking hands than Tony Iommi ever does. It's not really his strength. Iommi's strength is in his tone, his vibrato. He could do the straight ahead Priest chugs just as good as anyone else, sure, but it doesn't fucking sound like Tony Iommi, you know? Glory Ride is okay, though. I wouldn't wish it any harm. It's in a good spot on the album. Probably the best Iommi guitar solo on the record, too. So we flip over to the B-side from there, and this is where it picks up again. And to me, this is the straight fire. Well, entire B-side I love. Starting with Born to Lose. Fucking awesome. The hotline of Eternal Idol, if you will. An outstanding deep cut. I love this fucking raunchy one. And the little vocal things that come over this guitar riff here. I won't be too long. It's sung right on the guitar riff. It's fucking cool on the recording. You can listen to it. It was actually a Ray Gillen part that Martin carried through as well. But I think Martin nails it best. Born to Lose just showcases a bit of Martin's lower register too in his voice. He builds, as opposed to some of the other songs where he kind of comes in too hot, I find. You know, like Hard Life to Love, he just comes in too hot there. Glory Ride, same thing. Actually, those two songs are kind of stronger with the Ray Gillen vocal, in my opinion. So far, when looking at the two vocalists that were involved in this record, I like Martin's tracks best on the first two, The Shining and Ancient Warrior, and then Gillen on Hard Life to Love and Glory Ride. And then it's kind of a tie for this one, Born to Lose. It's really just a great fucking batch of song, regardless of who's singing. I love this album. I'm just kind of comparing the two because that's how I listen to it, kind of back and forth. I have the luxury to do that with these new deluxe editions that are at my fingertips, but ultimately, the Martin versions are the stronger ones, the more mixed ones, the more fucking heard ones. The album closes fucking strong too here. I love this whole side. So from that raunchy Born to Lose one, Jeff Nichols gives us another little keyboard interlude, but this one's fucking cool, man. Hell, I'm just gonna fucking play it for you because it's so badass. And this is a tribute to Jeff Nichols too, so don't fucking sue me. I know I slag Nichols a lot for being Iommi's bitch, but he brought so much fucking cool atmosphere to Sabbath, he deserves a little tribute. His parts are a huge vibe on this album and moving forward into the Tony Martin years. Here's his tribute to Freddy Krueger for you. Yeah, very Freddy, and rightfully so, as this is part of a track that was conceived for the A Nightmare on Elm Street 3. Yes, before George Lynch and the Dawkins crew took the reins, it was the Sabs who were set to be the big hair farm associated with the motherfucking Dream Warriors. An iconic soundtrack spot there in hindsight. I'm not sure if Sabbath got rejected or decided to pull out of the movie, but Dawkins ended up getting huge because of Dream Warriors. Even I knew them when I was like fucking 7 or 8 at the time. Too young to be watching Freddy, maybe, but hey, I turned out all right, right? I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy. Anyway, the rest of the tracks are great. Just fucking sleazy riff collage, this song Nightmare. Another top track for me. Nightmare's the fucking shit. And then from there we go to track 7. We get a proper fucking Tony Iommi guitar-led interlude. So here's Ben to play that for us. These little interludes. A welcome return to the good old days when it wouldn't be fucking Jeff Nichols sitting on a keyboard to make instrumentals. We get tracks like this, the Scarlet Pimpernel, following the footsteps of Fluff, Laguna Sunrise, Embryo, fucking Orchid, all those lovely Iommi parts. Now, of course, the first thing you do when you hear the title, right? Scarlet Pimpernel. You gotta fire up the old Google search and see what the fuck that's about. What the fuck is a Scarlet Pimpernel? Siri? Alexa? Anyone? Here's what the search results yield for you here, though. The Scarlet Pimpernel, 1905, a novel by Baron Orczy. That's a fucking Polish name, I don't know how to say it. The Scarlet Pimpernel is a name used by Sir Percy Blakeney, an Englishman who uses many clever disguises in order to help French people from high society escape from France and from the possibility of having their heads cut off by the guillotine during the French Revolution. So there you go. Fucking Tony Iommi must have been reading the book at the time and he wanted to look all learned and shit. Hey man, I got some fucking fine art on the front cover and I'm reading this book about the fucking French Revolution. I'm a cultured cat, not just a dirty brummy. Trying to hide his dirty brumminess. So the story goes, when he was recording the Scarlet Pimpernel in the studio, his old friend Bev Bevan came down to the studio for a visit. He got asked to do some percussion bits on this little guitar instrumental that he was working on. So he did, which is why his name is in the album credits there. You can't really hear that much on the final recording. It's just some cymbal swells, really, that he brings in. But he's on there. So there's two more tracks to cover here. First, there's one more little dirty metal hit for you with Lost Forever, which is another one that I actually like the Ray Gillen cut for a little more. There's something about these galloping ones that sound better when they're not overproduced. And the range that Gillen seems most comfortable in, it really lays on top of this thrashier kind of stuff. Lost Forever is fucking cool, but it more or less gets crushed by the closer. I guess it sets it up, right? So let's just get to it. Some straight up fucking doom metal to close. We'll display this one with a live tribute recording here. It needs to have a proper play. So, this is from a tribute act out of Turin, Italy, called Symptoms of Sabbath. Obviously covering the whole catalog of the Sabs, if the Eternal Idol is in the fucking set, right? I love it. And you know what?
Far the rift compels me!
Another fucking iconic closer from Black Sabbath. This one could even give Over and Over and fucking Lonely is the Word a run for their money. Almost getting up into fucking The Writ and Under the Sun territory. Not quite that level though, but close. The title track, The Eternal Idol. Just a fucking juggernaut. My favorite from the album, hands down. It's just a Sabbath doom at its finest. And also, shit, it's like, did fucking Geezer come back and write this one? Check out these lyrics here. No one said it would have to be this way. Why are we the victims of their final word? Dying world is killing us slowly. I believe no God may save us now. Can't you see what I see? Sinners, say your prayers tonight. Your judgment day is here. Fucking pitch perfect classic Black Sabbath here. Daisley's done his fucking homework. Penning this one. Go listen to The Eternal Idol right fucking now, okay? The whole album, front to back. This one is not to be skipped, guys. I mean, no Sabbath is to be outright skipped, but this one especially is badass coming off of 7 Star. Already up there with the Dio stuff for me. I won't bother getting too much into the bonus tracks here, as they kind of made the right choice in keeping that shit off the main album. But there are two tracks from these sessions that surface on some of the satellite EPs, Some Kind of Woman and Black Moon, the latter of which actually surfaces again later down the road on another LP, where it benefited from some time in mixing, and I'll talk about it then. But it's really cool they kind of released everything with this batch. It's pretty awesome to have access to all this material, including the fucking Ray Gillen demos and stuff. There's a great little Eternal Idol worship package out there if you're into this stuff, which I am. All right, so with this outstanding album in tow, the two Tonys and Jeff, they still needed a rhythm section to roll with on tour, right? So while finishing touches were being put on the album and the presentation, Meehan already had a couple of gigs lined up for them to hit the road in that fucking lovely caravan.
It is a funny story. I think those stories are kind of best in the caravan.
As mentioned in the track by track there, Iommi had been in touch with his good old friend Bev Bevan when he laid down some barely audible percussion on the Scarlet Pimpernel there. At the time, Tony also put feelers out about getting Bev back in the band for the tour since Eric Sanger was done by then. He also somehow had gotten Geezer to agree to come back on board. So it was going to be Bev and Geez joining on. The old fucking born again tour rhythm section. No fucking rehearsals required. Let's fucking roll. The first gig was going to be July 18th at the Plymouth Rock Festival. However, when Geezer learned that Tony was back in bed with Meehan, he just fucking pulled out. Or at least that's the impression I've gotten from articles about his involvement. You'll have to ask Geezer himself exactly what the managerial situation was that prevented him from touring the Eternal Idol. I think it was fucking Meehan. Like, Geezer's a fucking smart guy. He wouldn't stand for being managed by Patrick again. There's no way. And Meehan had quickly lined up a couple of very shady gigs, which we'll get into now. So they gave the Beast a call. They brought back David Spitz. Gave him that quick call-up for the fast-approaching gigs here. Naturally, the only bass player who knew the set and could slot in on such short notice. So even if there was some bad blood after the studio debacle that went on, Spitz could basically just name his price. And so the Ancient Warriors marched on to Athens, Greece. July 20th, 1987, at the Panathinaikos Stadium. Black Sabbath were back. First time ever playing in Greece, too. Iommi, Martin, Nichols, Spitz, and Bevan. The lineup's first, and actually only, appearance. This is also Martin's first Sabbath gig ever. Here's how it unfolded. They hit the stage with some Dio material. Neon Nights to open, and Children of the Sea, the 1-2 Heaven and Hell punch there. Then into the classic War Pigs. Then they slipped in some Seven Star shit. Danger Zone made it into the set. Strange, but... And then, just as David Spitz started in with NIB... The Greeks got a little out of hand. Apparently, at this time, someone had climbed up the lighting scaffolds over the stage, and the band just stopped the set, claiming that security wasn't doing their job and endangering them. The fans, of course, then rioted, as they do. So that was the grand return of Sabbath. The live debut of Tony Martin 2. Five songs or so, and then a fucking riot. And so after Greece, the Meehan Mayhan tour just fucking keeps rolling, because... Patrick had gone and booked the boys into Sun City, South Africa, a very controversial venue. This was still before the Apartheid fell, so Sabbath took a lot of shit in the press. And if you didn't know what the Apartheid is, don't worry, I had to look it up too. I'm probably not pronouncing it right there either, but it was essentially politically approved racial segregation imposed by the white minority that was ruling in South Africa in the 70s and 80s, but even before that, probably 60s. A terrible reign. It lasted well into the 90s. It's still fucking prevalent today. So, Sun City venue was actually officially a whites-only gig. And Tony Iommi, of course, he's always quick to pass the blame on for his own mistakes. In an interview, he says that Meehan told him Sun City wasn't actually in South Africa. But for fuck's sake, man, you have musician friends who played there. Fucking Queen and Brian May, your little bum buddy there. Just... fucking own it, Tony. You didn't give a shit as long as Sabbath was drawing crowds, right? So Bev Bevan, being the class dude that he is, he objected to playing Sun City and left the band before the dates. So Terry Chimes, the ex-Clash drummer, who also played in the Shining video, as I mentioned, was next in line for Tony to bring on. He knew he was a fan, and obviously, since he had agreed to be in the video earlier, had a fucking grasp on some of the Sabbath material. But Terry was a punk. Like, he was in the Clash, man. So... punk drums in the Sabs, would that work? A lot of Bill Ward's patterns in particular require a lot of constraint, not just fucking blasting out. Here's what Terry said in an interview about joining on with Black Sabbath. Seems he was aware of these same concerns that I'm kind of having here. It's funny, because I remember going to rehearsal and playing the song Black Sabbath for the first time, which is very slow. I started playing it, and the bass player was telling me, "No, you gotta play it really slow. This is beyond slow." So I followed him, and it worked. But I remember listening to Black Sabbath even when I was still in school, and Tony Iommi's guitar playing was always so immense. Also, they were into great big drum kits on stage, drum solos. I'd never done any of that. So I thought, this would be fantastic. Of course, in the punk thing, there was none of that. You weren't supposed to do those things. But what I found out was people love drum solos. They really love them. I don't know what it is, but something really connects with them. Some people love them. I can't stand fucking drum solos. But there you go. But, you know, The Clash isn't really punk. I mean, they've always had that kind of crossover appeal. There's tons of fucking reggae and hard rock vibes in their stuff. They even get fucking proggy at times. The Clash are fucking great. So he wasn't a hacky punk drummer by any means. He could still hang with the Sabs. So the rhythm section was set, though. They could press on. Spitz stayed on in the bass slot. He didn't have any fucking problem playing the Sun City gigs. Altogether, there were 6 shows played in Sun City. July 25th and 26th, then they had 4 days off. August 1st and 2nd, 6 days off, then August 8th and 9th. So here's Tony recounting that famous Sun City debacle. Like I said, caught some real shit for this too, playing these gigs, and rightfully so. But here's how Tony recounts the whole deal. One of the first things we did when we got to South Africa was go to Johannesburg and do some press. Right in the middle of doing that, somebody let a bomb off down the road. That was the only sign of any trouble that I noticed. It wasn't connected to us, it was just one of those things. Well, I hope it wasn't to do with us. The promoter took us out on a safari. We left at 5 o'clock in the morning in a couple of open-top Land Rovers, and all I saw was the dust from the car in front. We'd stop for a bit, look in the distance, and everybody would go, "No, I can't see anything." We saw nothing. Absolutely fuck all. Great safari. Oh, poor Tony. Little white boy. Didn't get to see some big kitty cats on his safari. Maybe because your shit Land Rover is kicking up so much dust, man. Sun City turned out to be a great place to play. We did 6 shows in 3 weeks, playing Saturdays and Sundays. During the week, it was as dead as a doornail there. But on the weekends, when we played, it was packed. The promoter was black, and we were playing to audiences just like everywhere else, black and white. Okay, so he's trying to clear up the whole whites only thing, but it's been reported that that is what the venue was, or at least, you know, there would be very few black people in there. He's trying to make it sound like a lovely gig, though, isn't he? They'd never seen us, and we did a couple of great shows. To me, it was another gig. Why not branch out? I never thought about the political side of it. I was a bit blind to all that. I didn't know how bad it was. I just thought, I'm a musician. I want to play and get my music around wherever I can. But boy, did I get some stick for playing Sun City. And when I got there, I saw all these pictures on the walls of all these bands that had played before us, like Queen, Status Quo, so I wonder why it was me who was getting all the shit then. They really came down on me hard back in England, but I can't say I regret doing it. Fans are fans, and it seems a shame that these people shouldn't be able to hear our music. Yeah, okay. I think money had something to do with it too there, Tony boy. It wasn't a fucking charity gig, that's for sure. After the Sun City gigs, though, David Spitz leaves the band permanently on August 15th. So the boys kind of take September off, and it's around this time that they recruit bassist Joe Burt, as they're all set for a little Eastern European first leg of the tour to kick stuff off proper once the album actually hits the shelf. They wanted to be out there gigging, so you know me, the second something's going on in the 4-string spot, I dive the fuck in, right? So here's a clip for you from the new bassist, Joe Burt, talking about his stint in the Eternal Idol tour. You can almost qualify this little story he tells here as a none more Black Sabbath moment. It has a fucking Spinal Tap vibe to it. So let's just flag it for the crack.
He's right. There's something about this that's so black. It's like, how much more black could this be? And the answer is none.
We were playing mainly through Europe. It was not the longest touring that I've been doing. It was over a month or so or something. It was a lot of laughs. It was a new experience in the fact that nearly all the audience were male. Most of them knew the bass lines better than I did. I'd been brought in because somebody had quit the band and the bass player had left, and it was short notice. So I had literally a few days rehearsal, and it's an awful lot for any bass player who knows the riffs that are involved in playing with Sabbath. And at the time, I'd been into Sabbath in their earlier days, so I wasn't completely au fait with all their stuff, and especially not on the Eternal Idol album, right, which actually I thought was quite good. And there was two or three songs off there that we played that I really enjoyed playing. But Paranoid, of course, we opened with, and the stage was so covered in smoke for the first 30 seconds, 40 seconds, nobody could see anything anyway, in front, behind, or you couldn't see the band. And the volumes that were just ridiculous. I mean, again with the bass guitar, it's air movement and the stacks that I had, if I didn't actually stop the guitar from ringing, it would have gone on forever, you know. So it's a beast when you're playing at that level. And so it was a learning curve, major learning curve for me, but a lot of fun. And Tony, you know, we met in the middle of the stage on one gig and crossed guitars, and then he took his fingers off in front of me, you know, and my legs gave way because I knew that he had fake fingers.
Right.
But in the heat of the moment with all the smoke and everything, he just removed them in front of me, and I just went, I mean, always playing jokes, you know. So, yeah, great experience.
Tony with the old a bit of finger gag gets the new guy every time. Sounds like Joe Bird had a good time, though. Although, it was a pretty dire tour by that point. The Euroswing would have been decent, as Sabbath have always drawn in Germany at that time. The set lists were made pretty fast, leaning hard on the classics, avoiding the Seventh Star material, thankfully. Here's a quote from a 1987 interview that Tony did when asked about the new set list. And he said, "We'll decide on that next week when we gear up for the tour. I think we'll do the title track and The Shining. Most of them, I guess. From the last album, The Seventh Star, I think we'll just keep the blues track, Heart Like a Wheel. The rest of the set will be classics like Paranoid and Iron Man. I didn't really like the last album, and the new one is a lot better, I think." See, even he knows that The Seventh Star was a misstep. And when asked about the stage show for The Eternal Idol, he said, "We'll trim it down a little. There's no reason to go crazy with all that. That's a lesson that we learned on the Born Again tour. We could only use the entire set for one show, that entire tour." There you go, some classic Born Again slag there at the end. So they did 9 dates in Germany, 5 dates in Italy, a couple of festivals around Belgium, France, and the Netherlands, well into late December, and they were set to round things up with the classic Hammersmith Odeon New Year's Eve stint, which has become a staple in the Sabbath itinerary here. But unfortunately, they don't make it to Hammersmith to ring in the new year. And now this is where things really kind of stall out. I'll read a final excerpt here, an article from January 2nd, 1988. Kerrang! Magazine, our old friends. So, this is an article by Malcolm Dome, graciously archived by the fantastic Black Sabbath online website. What a website that is. I know I've plugged it a bunch of times, but go over there and fucking check out all that shit. Here's the Kerrang expose on the Eternal Idol tour stalling out fast, back when Kerrang was actually an interesting read, not just top 15 Killswitch Engage fucking songs or some shit like that. They write, "Let's talk about the cancellation of the Hammersmith Odeon, a last-minute affair that seems to have provided a whole host of reasons. Keyboardsman Jeff Nichols, when contacted by the office over the Christmas period, suggested that the decision was forced on the band because Iommi had tennis elbow. However, a major rehearsal studio in South London confirmed to us that the band's equipment had been impounded because of massive bills that remained unpaid. Another story suggested that Iommi was suffering from Singapore flu." So here you go. Tony talks here. This is what he says while in the thick of it too. So this will be great. Have a swig of beer. It's motherfucking story time again here. So Tony says, "Yes, our equipment had been impounded and I was suffering from a bout of what I thought was tennis elbow. But on top of that, I came down with the Singapore flu while in Europe and I got really ill. I couldn't shake it off and I felt horrible. Even now, the after effects haven't completely worn off. It's awful. The last thing I wanted to do was cancel the Hammersmith show. I was really looking forward to it, but we had no choice and all I can do is apologize to the fans. But we intend to reschedule the date as soon as possible, plus hopefully slotting in a couple of other British gigs. At present time, Black Sabbath are regrouping their forces. Meehan is out of the picture, which seems to have lifted an enormous weight from Iommi's shoulders, and new management has been appointed, namely Rockmasters, who also look after Zeno." Okay, so that's the first time I've heard the name Rockmasters, or fucking Zeno for that matter, but I know he ultimately ends up with Ian Gillan's manager, Ernest Chapman, so maybe this Rockmasters outfit was in the running first, or maybe that's Chapman's company, I don't know. Anyway, Tony talks more here. "The situation with Patrick was unworkable. We could never find him when the bills had to be paid, and apart from one girl in the office, there was no one that we could talk to about anything. It was a nightmare, and eventually, I was left with no option but to walk away and try to pick up the pieces. All I want to do is be left alone and get on with playing music." Okay, so blah, blah, blah. They go on about the Sun City and how it wasn't his fault. It wasn't me. Meehan told me it wasn't in South Africa. All that bullshit that I touched on already. Kerrang fluffs him up too, so still, even in the 80s, this is still some ragmag garbage, as per usual. They speculate about them moving forward by saying, the group are currently in rehearsal, with Iommi being joined by bassist Joe Burt, drummer Terry Chimes, lead vocalist Tony Martin, and keyboardist Nichols. The aim is to get a US tour as soon as possible, and then return here for some dates. However, whether the band actually hits the road with this lineup remains to be seen. Okay, ominous, yes, but they've already been touring with this lineup, Kerrang. Don't try to make it sound like they're scrambling. The fact of the matter is, despite me saying this is a fucking fantastic Sabbath album, which it is, The Eternal Idol becomes Sabbath's worst-selling LP ever. And ultimately, all those mistakes they made with Meehan, rotating the singer slot since Dio, Sun City, all of that cast this big fucking shadow over the precious idols and forced them to retreat, parking the caravan due to poor ticket sales in the US. And that's also the last we see of old Joe Burt and Terry Chimes, too. The next year or so is spent off of the road. 1988 spent pretty much sorting out the past, and it's much needed at this time, too. So Tony Iommi's new management comes in, gets to work clearing up all the Meehan fuckery. This was also the last offering on the Vertigo deal. After 18 years, Black Sabbath were without a record label. Okay, let's close it down. I'm ready to rest my goddamn voice here. Fuck. I plan on doing another fucking episode after this, so I'm gonna need another Coors Light. As I said, The Eternal Idol, fucking fantastic Sabbath record. A real turning point, too, so I'm glad to give it a good slab of time here on the show. And this is the last of the outlier albums, really. The not-quite-era eras. You could call it the first of the Tony Martin era, I guess. He is on there. But I'd consider it just as much a Ray Gillen crop of songs as it is a Tony Martin offering. But like I said, I have the benefit of listening to both of them simultaneously. The next few Tony Martin albums are their own kind of thing. And we're fastly approaching the 90s here too, so there's going to be a big shift in the way music sounds. There's only one more 80s offering to go. So as always, hit me up with some comments, some fucking conversations. Let's talk about Sabbath, guys, over on the symptom of the Twitterverse there, at SabbathBloodyPC, or email sabbathbloodypodcast@gmail.com. Subscribe on iTunes. Leave a review there, too. It's been kind of quiet over there. I used to get quite a few reviews, but I could use that bump now. Haven't gotten one in a while, and it keeps my feed going, people finding the show. So, all right, rise up! Here's a little David Donut Donato to play us out. Bog blast all of you. No way!